Well, hello everyone. It is time to read the Des Moines Register for this Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Dennis May, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Barb DeHeck. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. And now, let's take a look at the weather and the headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Statewide AccuWeather forecast calls for showers around the state this morning, otherwise mostly cloudy and breezy today with the winds from the west-northwest at 15 to 25 miles per hour. The forecast for Des Moines calls for a high today of 69 with a low of 49, breezy again, a couple of morning showers. Considerable cloudiness tonight. On Thursday, a high of 56 with a low of 36 and cooler with rain. Across the area, a couple of morning showers. Otherwise, going to be a cloudy and breezy day today. Turning over to the front page of today's Des Moines Register, our headlines are Bill to Arm Teachers Goes to the Governor, and Boone Council Approves Plan to Open Daisy Brand Plant, bringing 255 jobs. Before turning to our first article, there is a large photo on the front page. It shows Caitlin Clark on the stage at the WNBA draft earlier this week on Monday. She's standing on the stage, and to her left is the commissioner for the WNBA, Kathy Engelbert. And together, Caitlin with her right hand and Kathy with her left are holding at the shoulders a jersey from the Indiana Fevers, and it says Indiana number one. And the headline is A New Chapter for Clark, number one pick in the WNBA draft. University of Iowa basketball star Caitlin Clark left stands with WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert after Clark was selected with the number one overall pick by the Indiana Fever in Monday's draft. Clark captivated the sports world during her record-setting career with the Hawkeyes, leading Iowa to their national championship game in 2023 and 2024. Now, the West Des Moines native takes her long-distance shooting and dazzling passes to the professional level. Clark's Hawkeye teammate, Kate Martin, was chosen in the second round of the draft by Las Vegas. And now, and here to get us started with the stories in today's Des Moines Register is Barb.
Thank you, Dennis. A bill to arm teachers goes to the governor. Iowa lawmakers have sent a bill to Governor Kim Reynolds that would allow teachers and other school employees to obtain permits to carry guns on school grounds and grant them qualified immunity for using reasonable force. The Iowa House voted 62-36 Monday to send House File 2586 to Reynolds for her signature. One Republican, Representative Matthew Rinkler, Republican of Burlington, joined every Democrat in opposition. All other Republicans voted in favor. The Senate passed the measure last week. The bill also requires Iowa's largest school districts to employ school resource officers in their high schools unless their school board votes to opt out. Republican supporters of the bill have framed it as one of the state's responses to the deadly shootings at Perry High School in January, when a high school student shot and killed sixth grader Amir Jolif and principal Dan Marburger, and wounded half a dozen others before fatally shooting himself. Time and math do not lie, said Representative Phil Thompson, Republican of Boone, the bill's floor manager. The first 30 seconds in these scenarios are extremely critical. This bill does set a high standard for districts and staff that want to participate in this and go the extra mile to protect our kids. Gun violence prevention groups have held protests and spoken out against the bill, saying it will make students and school employees less safe by increasing the likelihood of accidents involving guns in schools. It does nothing to protect children who might be the victim of crossfires, of accidents, of a gun not being properly stored, or a curious student finding a gun and accidentally injuring other children, said Representative Beth Wessel Crochelle, Democrat of Ames. A 2023 report from the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence documented about 100 incidents of guns being mishandled, left in reach of children, or accidentally discharged at schools over the last 5 years. More than 30 states allow teachers or other K-12 school staff to be armed in at least some circumstances, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. What training would Iowa staff need to get a permit to carry guns at school? Those who want to carry firearms in schools will be required to go through a permit process that includes one-time in-person legal training covering qualified immunity, emergency medical training, and communications training, as well as quarterly firearm training and annual live scenario training. That process would be approved by the Iowa Department of Public Safety. The legislation allowing school employees to obtain professional permits to carry firearms applies to K-12 public and private schools, community colleges, and public and private colleges and universities. The identity of a staff member who has a professional carry permit would be confidential and exempt from Iowa's public records law. A Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll conducted in February found 60% of Iowans favored allowing teachers and other staff to carry firearms in schools after completing training. 38% opposed the policy, and 1% were not sure. The bill would give qualified immunity to armed school staff with professional permits, protecting them from civil lawsuits or criminal prosecution if they used reasonable force and acted within the course of their duties. Opponents have argued that exempting armed school employees and the districts themselves from lawsuits will leave families with no options to receive compensation if their loved one is shot at school. When you have no liability for teachers in the school district, all children will be at risk, Wessel Crochelle said. All families will have nowhere to go when their children are harmed or seriously injured. The legislation builds on previously passed law that let school employees carry firearms, but did not require districts' insurers to cover them. Two Iowa districts in recent years have approved arming their staffs before later reversing their policies. Spirit Lake and Cherokee both opted not to go forward after EMC Insurance declined to cover the rural districts ahead of the 2023-24 school year if they proceeded with arming staff. Last year, House lawmakers passed a bill that would have barred insurers from denying coverage to districts based solely on the district's decision to arm their staff, but the measure failed in the Senate. EMC Insurance has said it will continue to insure districts that use trained law enforcement or school resource officers. The group said in a statement last week that it shares a deep commitment to the health and safety of students and respects schools' rights to choose the policies they believe to be in their best interests. We believe this legislation could attract more insurance carriers to Iowa, along with potentially more options for schools to find coverage that fits their needs, the statement said. This would be a positive outcome for all. The state's largest school districts, those with 8,000 or more students, would be required to employ school resource officers in high schools unless the district school board votes to opt out. School districts with fewer than 8,000 students would be encouraged to employ school resource officers. The Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency reports that 11 districts will be required to hire at least one private school security officer or school resource officer. They are Ankeny, Cedar Rapids, Council Bluffs, Davenport, Des Moines, Dubuque, Iowa City, Sioux City, Waterloo, Waukee, and West Des Moines. It could cost school districts about $63,000 to employ a school resource officer, assuming they share some of the costs with local law enforcement. At a maximum, LSA calculates it would cost about $2.5 million for the 11 school districts to employ school resource officers at 40 high schools, as required by the bill. But some of those school districts already employ school resource officers, meaning they would not see increased costs. According to the LSA analysis, the Department of Public Safety would need to hire 8 positions to train SROs and school employees who obtain professional permits to carry guns at school, as well as develop a new records management system to track permits. That could cost the department about $600,000.
Our next article on the front page, today's Des Moines Register, Boone Council approves plan to open Daisy Brand Plant, bringing 255 jobs. The Boone City Council has approved a proposal by dairy products maker Daisy Brand to locate a plant in Boone that would bring 255 jobs to the city. The proposed development would represent an estimated $708 million investment, according to a resolution the council approved unanimously on Monday. The plant will make sour cream and cottage cheese. This project will be immensely beneficial to not only the city of Boone, but also Boone County and the entire central Iowa region. I am incredibly excited for the positive economic impact this project will bring and the continued success of Daisy Brands and their impeccable line of dairy products, as quoted by Boone Mayor Elijah Steins. In a written statement, Council Member David Byrd called the development, quote, a transformative thing not just for Boone, but the entire area. With the Boone Council's approval, Daisy will apply to the Iowa Economic Development Authority for consideration of economic development benefits under the state's High Quality Jobs Program. The IEDA board meets Friday. What products does Daisy Brand produce? Well, Daisy Brand is headquartered in Dallas and has plants in Garland, Texas, Casa Grande, Arizona, and Wooster, Ohio. It distributes its products in all 50 states and has the leading market share in both sour cream and cottage cheese, according to its website. A family-owned business that started in Chicago in 1917, Daisy has more than doubled its employment in the last 15 years, according to its website, and features the slogan, "A Dollop of Daisy." The company did not respond to a phone call seeking additional information on Monday. An expansion of the production capacity comes at a time when cottage cheese sales are on a significant upswing. Growth in cottage cheese sales has been attributed to cottage cheese, which has more than 323 million views on TikTok, as young consumers interested in adding protein to their diets are discovering the product. Tina Potthoff, spokesperson for Hy-Vee, said cottage cheese sales of Iowa's largest grocer are up 10% since the first of the year. The resolution the Boone Council approved Monday includes a property tax exemption of 100% for years 1 through 3 of the plant's operation and 74% for years 4 through 20. The city also would commit to $9.6 million upgrade of its wastewater facilities to meet project specifications, an $800,000 upgrade of a wastewater lift station, $3 million for a reservoir to bolster its water supply, and a 20% match for an estimated $800,400 in road improvements by the Iowa Department of Transportation. The Daisy Brand plant would be in Boone's Industrial Park on the eastern side of the city. Both Councilmember Terry Moorman and City Administrator William Scar said improvements to the wastewater treatment system and the roads within the industrial park were needed even before the Daisy proposal. Moorman said discussions with Daisy started months ago, and everybody has been on board. He praised the Boone County Economic Development Growth Corporation for its work to bring Daisy to the area. They really stepped up their game, Moorman said, of the Economic Development Organization. The proposal comes as the Fairway supermarket chain plans to move its corporate headquarters to Johnston from Boone later this year, shifting about 100 jobs out of Boone.
And in Metro and Iowa news, man convicted in the 2016 death of architect. The man charged with killing a prominent Des Moines architect more than 8 years ago has been convicted of involuntary manslaughter. Kurt Ronk was found in January 2016 with severe injuries at the bottom of a stairwell in the teacher building where he had an office. After he died, an autopsy determined the fatal injuries were sustained in a fall. Zachary Gaskell, 33, was quickly identified as the main suspect in Blunk's death. He was interviewed by police as a potential witness after surveillance images showed him in the area near the time Blunk was injured and told investigators he'd run into Blunk while searching for a bathroom and that Blunk had attacked him. Blunk's family had sued Gaskell previously for wrongful death, accusing Gaskell of attacking Blunk and causing his fall. A judge awarded them $6.25 million in 2018. In 2022, prosecutors brought their own case, charging Gaskell with second-degree murder. Des Moines police said at the time that an ongoing investigation had turned up new facts supporting charges. The case went to trial last week, and jurors heard testimony from friends who were with Gaskell that day in the up-down bar in the basement of the teach-out building. They also heard from several ex-girlfriends who testified Gaskell had given them unprompted and at times inconsistent stories in which Blunk allegedly accused Gaskell of trying to break through a locked door on the sixth floor or attacked him with a knife. In one instance, Gaskell reportedly claimed Blunk had been touching women inappropriately and that Gaskell had been the one to initiate the confrontation. Because Gaskell had suggested Blunk was the aggressor, prosecutors also called several witnesses to testify to Blunk's character, all of whom described him as calm, positive, and never prone to temper or violence. Leslie Nesbitt, a current prosecutor who worked at the bar Blunk owned while in law school, said she saw him there the afternoon he was killed, and that, despite having several drinks, he seemed fully physically and mentally in control when he left. "I just can't say I ever saw Kirk act in the way I saw other bar patrons do when ordering drinks, slurring their words, falling down, any of that," she said. Gaskell's lawyer throughout the trial focused on the four whiskeys Blunk reportedly consumed before encountering Gaskell. In his closing argument, attorney Michael Adams argued Blunk's friends and family had every reason after his death to overstate his ability to hold his alcohol, and there was no evidence Gaskell intended to kill Blunk as required for a murder conviction. The jury heard closing arguments Friday morning and returned their verdict that afternoon for the lesser offense of involuntary manslaughter, a misdemeanor carrying up to 2 years in prison or potentially probation. In a statement through their attorney, Grant Woodard, Blunk's family thanked investigators and prosecutors for securing a conviction. Quote, "While we are disappointed with the verdict, we are glad that everyone will know that Gaskell is responsible for Kirk Blunk's death," they said. As a developer and architect, Blunk was a major player in the decades before his death in the economic development of the East Village. He specialized in renovating historic buildings, and his firm worked on 13 projects in the East Village, including the Teach-Out Building, which he owned, as well as the Crane Artist Lofts on the west side of downtown and other projects in Sherman Hill and at the Des Moines Art Center. Several of those projects later ran into problems, including a Sherman Hill apartment building ordered vacated because of code violations. Gaskell is scheduled for sentencing on June 6th.
Also on the front page of today's Metro and Iowa section, Ankeny Ragbri sculpture to remain, at least for now. Trailhead landmark could see upgrades in future if condition deteriorates. A new Ankeny landmark will be sticking around. City Public Works and communications staff created the Ankeny bicycle sign last year to welcome riders on the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride across Iowa. Ragbri passed through Ankeny last July on the route's fourth day. The sign, which spells out the city's name in big block letters surrounded by a pyramid of bicycles, sits at the northwestern trailhead off northwest Irvindale Drive. The bicycle sign was intended to be a short-term feature for Ragbri and not constructed to be permanent, but the installation has been well received by community members, according to city documents, and city officials have now taken steps to formally approve its location. The city's Cultural Arts Board has recommended leaving the bicycle sculpture at its current location while monitoring the condition of the materials and the structural stability. The city council signed off on the recommendation as part of the consent agenda at its Monday meeting. The sculpture's condition is expected to be evaluated in July of 2026. Possible future upgrades, which would make the sign more permanent, could include powder coating the steel structure and placing the sculpture on a concrete pad. Officials would consider upgrades as the structure deteriorates and needs improvements. The trailhead, which connects Ankeny to the High Trestle Trail, has another public art installation called Drop-In that serves as a home for trail goers. Also on the front page, short article, prosecutor reprimanded over sexual comments, judges, defendants targeted in remarks. The Iowa Supreme Court has reprimanded an elected county prosecutor after it found he made repeated sexual comments at work. An attorney disciplinary panel had recommended Wapello County Attorney Reuben Neff to be suspended for 60 days after two female former employees in his office complained about Neff's inappropriate statements. Among other incidents, Neff was accused of talking about judges whose rulings he disagreed with in sexually derogatory terms, joking about criminal defendants being sexually assaulted, and using slurs about gay people even after an employee objected. The final disciplinary decision was the Supreme Court's to make, and Neff's attorney argued that Iowa's attorney conduct rules are unconstitutionally overboard and should not be used as, quote, general civility code. In its order Friday, the Supreme Court ruled without dissent that Neff's body language was not constitutionally protected, but chose to reprimand him instead of suspending his license. Justice Christopher McDonald, writing for the five participating justices, wrote that Neff's misconduct is comparable but less severe than that in a 2020 case where the former Van Buren County attorney had his license suspended for 6 months after repeatedly sexually harassing his office staff. In this case, Neff made 9 inappropriate statements. His comments generally were not targeted toward people in the office, McDonald wrote. On balance, we conclude that a public reprimand is the appropriate sanction for Neff's improper statements here. Neff's attorney did not return a message seeking comment.
Iowa Democrats outfundraise GOP incumbents in early 2024. Iowa Democratic congressional candidates Christina Bohannon and Lennon Baucom again raised more money than their Republican challengers during the most recent fundraising period, New Public Finance Reports show. Although the Republican incumbents in each of Iowa's 4 congressional districts have more money in the bank, Bohannon is inching closer to incumbent Republican U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, who she's challenging in the first district race. The reports, which cover the fundraising period from January 1st through March 31st, were released on April 15th. They come as Iowa's relatively sleepy primary season moves toward the June 4th election date. Bohannon, an Iowa City law professor and former state legislator, raised $820,981, compared with Miller Meeks' $378,901. The haul puts Bohannon nearly on par with Miller Meeks for cash on hand, a key metric that shows how much each candidate has available. Bohannon reported about $1.6 million on hand, and Miller Meeks has nearly $1.8 million, filing show. Baucom, a veteran and former U.S. Department of Agriculture official, is challenging Republican U.S. Representative Zach Nunn in the 3rd District. He raised the most of any candidate this quarter, $901,528. Compared to Nunn's $524,270. Democrat Melissa Vine, a nonprofit leader, is also running in the 3rd District primary race against Baucom, but she reported raising far less, about $68,000. Baucom is in the endorsement of some major Democratic players in Iowa, as well as a Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. The 1st and 3rd Congressional District races are expected to be the most competitive contests in Iowa this cycle. Here's a look at how much the candidates reported raising and spending during the first 3 months of 2024, plus how much they have in the bank. The tally does not include candidates who may have declared their intention to run, but who have not raised enough money to require filing with the FEC. In the 1st Congressional District, Republican Marionette Miller Meeks, the incumbent, raised this period $378,901. Raised in the election cycle to date, $2,691,316. Spent this period, $189,551. Spent this election cycle to date, $1,563,64. And the cash on hand, $1,774,125. Republican David Pouch raised this period, $28,205. Raised in the election cycle to date, $28,205. Spent this period, $21,340. Spent in the election cycle to date, $21,340. And the cash on hand, $7,865. Democrat Christina Bohannon Raised this period, $820,981. Raised in the election cycle to date, $2,143,456. Spent this period, $309,677. Spent in the election cycle to date, $601,620. With cash on hand of $1,666,061. In the 2nd Congressional District, incumbent Republican Ashley Hinson raised this period $606,423. Raised in the election cycle to date, $3,440,823. Spent this period, $379,167. Spent in the election cycle to date, $2,069,991. And cash on hand, $1,668,202. And Democrat Sarah Corkery raised this period $106,071. Raised in the election cycle to date, $156,714. Spent this period, $62,316. In the election cycle to date, spent $76,956. And cash on hand, $79,757. In the 3rd Congressional District, Republican Zach Nunn, the incumbent, raised this period $524,270. Raised in the election cycle to date, $2,977,354. Spent this period, $271,276. And spent in the election cycle to date, $1,270,755. With a cash on hand of $1,547,579. Lennon Baucom, a Democrat, raised this period $901,528. Raised in the election cycle to date, $1,408,834. Spent this period, $192,079. Spent in the election cycle to date, $254,865. With a cash on hand of $1,153,969. Democrat Melissa Vine raised this period $68,445. Raised in the election cycle to date, $121,119. Spent this period, $47,437. And spent in the election cycle to date, $53,549. With a cash on hand of $67,570. And in the 4th Congressional District, Republican Randy Feenster, the incumbent, raised this period $818,411. Raised in the election cycle to date, $3,075,314. Spent this period, $776,317. Spent in the election cycle to date, $2,096,065, with a cash on hand of $2,079,025. Republican Kevin Virgil raised this period $42,560. Raised in the election cycle to date, $42,560. Spent this period, $34,952. Spent this election cycle, $34,952. With a cash on hand of $7,608. And Democrat Ryan Milton raised this period $13,682. Raised this election cycle to date, $36,577. Spent this period, $4,772. Spent in the election cycle to date, $24,722. And with a cash on hand of $19,547.
From Altoona, Altoona agrees to annexation moratorium with Mitchellville. Altoona has approved an agreement with Mitchellville to set a line that limits future annexation. On the table was a proposed annexation moratorium agreement with Mitchellville that would draw a line along Northeast 96th Street from Interstate 80 to Northeast 46th Avenue. The cities could not cross the line as they expand, according to city documents. The Altoona City Council approved the agreement following a public hearing at its Monday meeting. Des Moines area communities can grow by annexing sections of unincorporated Polk County into their city borders. Under the moratorium agreement, which would last 10 years, Altoona could not annex land east of the line, while Mitchellville could not annex west of it. The line divides an undeveloped area. Altoona also would not be able to annex Thomas Mitchell Park, which is south of the line and currently outside either city limits, but is strongly tied to Mitchellville's community identity and named after the town's founder, who played a significant role in the area's history and development. The proposal says the agreement would allow for orderly planning and development while ensuring communication between the two cities as they grow. The Mitchellville City Council approved the agreement on April 1st. Mitchellville officials have said they would have ideally wanted the dividing line to extend further south than Northeast 46th Avenue. The agreement would not block the cities from making annexations across 96th Street south of there. And from Des Moines, High Court rejects Des Moines Police Department appeal in protest lawsuit. The U.S. Supreme Court won't weigh in on a photographer's lawsuit against the Des Moines Police Department. Ted Neeters, a freelance photographer, was pepper spray tackled and arrested while taking photos of a group of protesters on June 2nd of 2020 near the Iowa Capitol. His failure to disperse charge was later dropped, and he sued the department and arresting officer Brandon Holton for unlawful seizure, excessive force, and retaliation. A federal district judge ruled for the city in 2022, finding Holton had arguably probable cause for the arrest and was thus entitled to immunity. But a federal appellate court in October reviewed the case, finding Holton was not entitled to immunity on Neeters' case or Neeters' false arrest and excessive force claims. That ruling put the case back on track toward trial, but in February the city appealed the case again, this time to the U.S. Supreme Court. In its brief to the court, the city argued the lower appellate court's decision eviscerated problem or probable cause standards by placing an impossible burden on law enforcement and disregard prior Supreme Court holdings that police can only be held liable if the illegality of the actions is established, with a high level of specificity, I can't say that, excuse me, by prior case law. The Supreme Court receives thousands of appeals each year, but agrees to hear only about 1% of them. Neeters, represented by attorney Gina Mesimer, did not file a reply brief with the court, which nonetheless denied the city's petition Monday without comment. The denial puts the case back on track toward trial, which currently is scheduled for August. Des Moines has recently gotten adverse rulings in several cases arising from the 2020 George Floyd protests. A judge last month denied police immunity on a lawsuit from a former assistant attorney general who lived downtown, and the city agreed to settle another suit for $150,000 in December after a jury found officers who pepper sprayed a woman violated her rights.
And turning to national and world news. Iran faces sanctions in Israel attack. Israel's foreign minister on Tuesday said he's leading a diplomatic offensive against Iran following Saturday's unprecedented attack on Israel and amid global efforts to calm tensions between the two countries to prevent a wider war in the Middle East. Israel Katz said in a social media post that he's calling for sanctions to be imposed on the Iranian missile project and that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps will be declared a terrorist organization to curb and weaken Islam. Katz's efforts include sending letters to 32 countries and conversations with dozens of foreign ministers. Iran must be stopped now before it is too late, he said. Other diplomatic efforts are being carried out to calm tensions between the two foes on Tuesday. In Brussels, the European Union's Foreign Affairs Council was set to meet, as were foreign ministers for Germany and Jordan in Berlin. It is incredibly important for us that the German federal government in these fragile times, that we all work together to contribute to de-escalation for the entire region, Baerbock said in a news conference with her Jordanian counterpart, Amin Safadi. Israel's war cabinet was scheduled to meet Tuesday for at least the third time in 3 days to weigh a response to Iran's missile and drone blitz, which was launched over a suspected Israeli airstrike on Iran's embassy compound in Syria. The April 1st attack killed 7 Iranian military officers. Military Chief of Staff Herzi Halevi has said the Iranian attack will be met with a response. No decision has been announced. President Joe Biden said the U.S., which along with Israel and Jordan intercepted hundreds of missiles and drones launched from Iran, will continue to defend its ally, but will not be part of any retaliatory measure against Iran for Saturday's attack. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi said that Tuesday that Tehran will respond to any actions against its interests, Reuters reported, citing Iranian student news agency. Quote, we categorically declare that the smallest action against Iranian interests will certainly be met with a severe, widespread, and painful response against any perpetrator, Raisi told the Qatar Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators demanding a ceasefire in Gaza, blocked bridge traffic in San Francisco and New York, and prompted some air travelers in Chicago to ditch their rides and reach the airport on foot, as coordinated protests caused disruptions across several cities in the U.S. and internationally Monday. The organizing A15 Action Group said on its website that the global economy is complicit in genocide, and together we will coordinate and to disrupt and blockade economic logistical hubs and the flow of capital. That meant shutting down the Golden Gate Bridge during the morning commute, snarling traffic into and out of San Francisco for hours. A group carrying a banner that read, Stop the World for Gaza, was eventually cleared off. Across the bay in Oakland, protesters forced the closure of two sections of Interstate 880, using weighted barrels to block the road. In New York, hundreds of demonstrators halted afternoon traffic by clogging the Brooklyn Bridge, bringing on a large police response. And in Chicago, the highway that goes into O'Hare Airport was jammed by a protest, leading several passengers to walk to the terminal with their luggage. Road blockages from protests were also reported in Philadelphia, San Antonio, Texas, and Eugene, Oregon, where 52 demonstrators were arrested, in addition to Ottawa, Ontario. In Italy, an artist representing Israel at the Venice Biennale Art Fair said she was refusing to open the National Pavilion until a ceasefire and hostage deal was reached. I feel that the time for art is lost, Ruth Pautier wrote in a statement on Instagram, explaining why she and the exhibit's two curators had decided to shutter the show. And so, if I am given such a remarkable stage, I want to make it count. More than 33,800 people have been killed and over 76,000 injured in Gaza since October 7th, according to the Palestinian health authorities. The war was launched in response to Hamas attacks on Israel, in which 1,200 people were killed and 253 people taken hostage, according to Israel's tally. About 133 hostages remain captive. A new UN report estimates over 10,000 Palestinian women, including more than 6,000 mothers, have been killed since the start of the war in Gaza. The report released Tuesday said more than 19,000 children have been orphaned and that over 1 million women still in Gaza are facing a barrage of threats amid a worsening humanitarian disaster. Quote, women who have survived have been displaced, widowed, and facing starvation, the U.S. report said. More than 1 million women and girls in Gaza have almost no food, no access to safe water, latrines, washrooms, or sanitary pads, with disease growing amidst inhumane living conditions. After scrutiny from U.S. and global outreach over the mounting humanitarian crisis in Gaza, Israel said last week that it had opened a northern crossing and that it would open a port in southern Israel to receive and deliver aid shipments. The U.N. on Tuesday said Israel continues to impose unlawful restrictions on the entry and distribution of humanitarian assistance, and the distribution remains a large barrier to getting desperately needed aid and supplies into the hands of Palestinian civilians. Quote, the High Commissioner repeats that there must be an immediate ceasefire, the hostages must be released, and full, unfettered humanitarian aid must be allowed to flow immediately, Ravina Shamdasani, spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office, said in a briefing in Geneva.
Can Dems win back blue-collar voters? As the late March sky lightened to a dappled purple, Tony Milladontri, 81, and his fellow retirees filed into Lori's Corner Kitchen in Lake Ariel, Pennsylvania, to sip coffee and chat about the issues facing the country. A union electrician, Milladontri, commuted into New York City every day for decades to bring light to the skyscrapers. He took pride in the work and made enough money to build a lake house. Now, he worries that rising costs are preventing others from finding the same opportunities. It's among the reason he plans to vote for former President Donald Trump. Quote, "We've changed tremendously," Meledantri said of the Democratic Party, which he left around 2016. "They used to help people. Now it doesn't seem that way." President Joe Biden's path to holding the White House could hinge on his ability to win back blue-collar voters like Meledantri, who live in Pennsylvania's 8th Congressional District. Their area is expected to serve as a barometer for disillusioned swing voters in post-industrial parts of the country. Trump won the district in 2020, but it returned a longtime Democratic representative to the U.S. House in 2022. Only two other congressional districts, Ohio's 9th and Maine's 2nd, experienced the same trend. The finicky politics reflect their common identity as once prosperous industrial hubs whose economies declined as manufacturing jobs moved abroad. Both Trump and Biden have heavily emphasized winning over similar voters in the last few weeks. Trump held a weekend rally in Pennsylvania, and Biden campaigned in his hometown of Scranton on Tuesday, with events highlighting his economic, middle class, and tax policies. He plans to stay in Pennsylvania through Thursday. In 2016, Trump wooed working class voters in areas like Pennsylvania's 8th District with a message centered on economic grievances and a pledge to make America great again. He tapped into their anger toward politicians who many believed had discarded them in the global dustbin, and it worked. Luzerne County, a part of the district with a strong union presence, chose Barack Obama in 2012 by about 5 votes. Trump won in 2016 by almost 20. Thomas Shubilla, chair of the county's Democratic Party, argued that it wasn't so much the Democrats had failed unions, but they had failed to voice why Democrats are the union candidates. In 2020, Biden leaned into that by touting his own blue-collar roots and moderate message. In front of his childhood home, he unveiled an economic plan designed around building American manufacturing by using government investments to stimulate the infrastructure, energy, and healthcare industries. Though Biden didn't win the district, he built on Hillary Clinton's lead in the Democratic strongholds like Scranton and shrank Trump's margin in the district's rural communities. However, Ben Toll, a professor at Wilkes University, suggested that the incumbent Democratic president might have a harder time this year. "The mood of the country is still not supportive of Biden's presidency," he said. "He needs to win the places that he can win, and maybe other, more progressive Democrats can't." Democratic representatives who have won over working-class conservative voters have done so by campaigning almost exclusively on the infrastructure and jobs bills that have passed. That may provide a roadmap for Biden in 2024. Representative Matt Cartwright, a Democrat, has served Pennsylvania's 8th District since 2013, partly due to his focus on passing district funding projects. Gerald Epalt, a 76-year-old self-described conservative Democrat, said that where Biden was doing a good job, Cartwright was doing an excellent job. "He's bringing in money, and he's supporting our Department of Defense industries. He's supporting infrastructure." The president appeared recently with Representative Marcy Kaptur of Toledo, who has held Ohio's northwestern 9th congressional district since 1983 as her state shifted from purple to red. Kaptur, currently the longest-serving woman in Congress, credits her tenacity to building and maintaining the industries in her district. "Voting for the automotive industry, not against it. Voting for the steel industry, not against it," said Kaptur, age 77. "People remember." United Auto Workers Local 14 President Tony Toddy said some members support Trump, but he can't see them backing Kaptur's Republican opponent, who supported anti-union legislation in the State House. Toddy praised Kaptur for securing federal funding for an electric vehicle center that will train students and mechanics as the auto industry evolves. "You won't agree with her 100% of the time, but she is effective," he said. Democratic Representative Jared Golden, 41, has served Maine's northern, right-leaning 2nd District since 2018. Trump won it in 2020 by 7 votes. When it comes to winning over more conservative voters, Golden, a Marine Corps veteran who has lived in the area for most of his life, doesn't have a replicable strategy. At the end of the day, it's just the majority of the voters in his district that recognize me as someone who gets them, he said. Jerry Bernaches, 61, voted for Trump in 2020, but supported Golden in 2022 because of the congressman's down-to-earth, typical Mainer style. If Biden and National Democrats want to win back voters like Bernaches, Golden suggested they need to spend more time talking with and understanding them. The party is just a little out of touch with working-class communities, he said.
Six jurors have been seated on the second day of Trump's NYC trial. What's harder to find, a seat on the subway during rush hour or the jury needed for former President Donald Trump's New York criminal trial? Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to conceal hush money payments to a porn star. Prosecutors allege the falsification was done to conceal campaign finance violations. The presumptive GOP presidential nominee pleaded not guilty. The court has called on 500 New Yorkers to glean 12 jurors and several alternates. It didn't look promising Monday afternoon, when more than half the first batch of 96 said they could not be impartial and were excused. No one expects them to have been living under a rock, Joshua Steinglass from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office told prospective jurors Tuesday. The important thing is that they are able to be fair. Judge Juan Merchan told them that jurors decided the facts in the case, whereas a judge decides the law. All day, attorneys questioned prospective jurors and examined social media posts that showed the reach of Trump's sentiments over the past decade. Merchan dismissed a man who posted "lock him up" about Trump and another who posted an anti-Trump video. He allowed a woman to continue despite Trump's team taking issue with a post her husband made 8 years ago, and another woman who posted a video of a possibly anti-Trump celebration, but said she did not participate. Despite the challenges, by the end of Tuesday, six jurors had been sworn in. Merchan told them to plan to return Monday morning, indicating that it's possible opening statements could happen next week. Before entering the courtroom, Trump said he should be campaigning. He argued that the payments were accurately described as legal expenses. He alleged again, without evidence, that the White House was directing the trial, quote, to try and win an election, end quote, and he repeated his fruitless call for Merchan to recuse himself. When Merchan greeted Trump, the former president grimaced. At various points during the day, Trump attacked the trial on social media. And the judge cracked down after he heard Trump making comments after a potential juror was questioned about a social media video. Quote, I will not have any jurors intimidated in this courtroom, Merchan said. The six jurors did not include Kara McKee, who had a job conflict. You felt like history was happening, she told a crowd of reporters. I wish I could have stayed. She reported being pleasantly surprised at the honesty of fellow jurors. Some disclosed they were on Trump mailing list or watched Fox News, while others said they had volunteered for anti-Trump causes, giving a clearer picture of the political makeup of the jury, which she said seemed fairly balanced. You got a sense that people were really trying to put anything they had brought to this aside and step in and do their civic duty, McGee said. Though McGee is not a fan of the former president, she thought he should get his day in court. The trial will be convened Thursday morning. And the Bidens released their 2023 tax returns. Trump declines. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden paid $146,629 in federal income taxes in 2023, after reporting income of $619,976, according to their joint tax return released Monday. The first couple paid an effective federal tax rate of 23.7%. It marks the 26th year the Bidens have released federal tax returns during the president's public life. Former President Donald Trump is again declining to release his latest federal tax returns after he broke from the bipartisan tradition of presidents disclosing the documents. The Bidens' joint income for 2023 was slightly more than the $579,517 they reported for 2022. Biden's presidential salary is $400,000. Jill Biden reported earning $85,985 from Northern Virginia Community College, where she teaches. The Bidens collected $129,876 in taxable interest, pensions and annuities, Social Security benefits, and IRA distributions, significantly more than in 2022, producing the spike in income. The First Lady also reported $4,115 in royalties from prior book publications. The Bidens reported charitable contributions totaling $20,477 to 17 charities, including $5,000 to the Beau Biden Foundation, named for the Bidens' late son. The first couple also paid $30,908 in Delaware income tax, while Jill Biden reported paying $3,549 in taxes to Virginia. Vice President Kamala Harris and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff reported paying $88,570 in federal income tax in 2023, amounting to an effective 19.7% federal tax rate, while earning income of $450,299. The second couple reported donating $23,026 to charities. It was the 20th year Harris has released tax returns. Although Trump has not released past returns willingly, House Democrats in 2022 released 6 years of Trump's tax returns for the time he was president and campaigning for the presidency, from 2015 to 2020. The House Ways and Means Committee, then under the control of Democrats, used oversight powers to obtain the documents from the Internal Revenue Service. They totaled almost 6,000 pages. The Joint Committee on Taxation, staffed with tax experts, found Trump paid $1.1 million in federal income taxes during the first 3 years of his presidency and paid no federal tax in 2020, the year he claimed a loss of $4.8 million. Quote, President Trump has released more information to the American public about his personal finances than any candidate in history, Trump campaign spokeswoman Caroline Leavitt said in a statement when asked whether Trump will make his 2023 tax returns public. Leavitt added that Trump's past tax returns were illegally leaked by the IRS, and his successful family business has been the target of endless investigations led by Joe Biden and Democrat prosecutors, end quote.
Analysis. Trump targets voters in weirdest way. New York courthouse becoming candidate's dump spot. Donald Trump did not look chagrined as he prepared to walk into a New York courtroom and become the first former president in American history to be tried after being accused of a crime. Quote, "This is an assault on America," he told reporters gathered in a hallway, calling the charges nonsense and an outrage, and repeating his unfounded assertion that President Joe Biden was behind his prosecution on 34 counts of violating New York state law. "This is really an attack on a political opponent. That's all it is," Trump said as a police dog barked in the background. "So I'm very honored to be here." Never before has a former president faced criminal charges. Never before has a presumptive presidential nominee been compelled to spend at least 4 days a week sitting in a courtroom and with a gag order limiting his attacks on those involved in his prosecution on social media. And never before has a national candidate taken what would have otherwise been a death blow and embraced it as a political asset. Of course, Trump already made a scowling mugshot taken at Georgia's Fulton County Jail for other criminal charges an iconic image, now plastered on T-shirts and coffee mugs, flags and posters, and digital trading cards. He has been running against Biden more or less continuously since 2020, when they faced off in an election that Trump lost but never conceded. But in the same ways the 2024 general election campaign began Monday at 100 Center Street in Lower Manhattan, it's chronicled by a half dozen pool reporters and a sketch artist sitting in the benches in the 15th floor courtroom. With the Republican and Democratic nominations now settled, this trial may be the best chance of opening up a contest that is tight as a tick. The question for voters is Trump unfit for the presidency if he is convicted of falsifying business records to cover up hush money he paid to an adult film actress or actor in an attempt to deep six a political embarrassment during the last campaign? Or is he the unfair victim of politically motivated prosecution and charges he denies and deems unimportant. Those are the same questions that will face the dozen jurors and six alternatives being selected over the next week or so, with consequences more personal for Trump than those in his last two trials. A federal defamation trial brought by E. Jean Carroll in a civil fraud case brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James carried the threat of her financial penalties, enormous ones, as it turned out, but not prison time. In the new case, people of the state of New York against Donald J. Trump, each of the 34 Class E felonies carries a maximum sentence of 4 years, although many legal experts find the prospect of an extended incarceration for the former president unfathomable. Political consequences loom, too. The allegations, some of them legal and some personal, that have swirled around Trump for years haven't shaken his core support. Even those relating to the January 6, 2021 assault on the Capitol have galvanized his political support and made it politically unwise for his GOP rivals for the nomination to attack him. Now, the most recent national polls, averaged by RealClearPolitics.com, finds a contest that is essentially tied, Trump at 45.6%, Biden at 45.4%. Could this trial royal a race even though views of both major contenders seem set in concrete? Maybe. In a USA Today Suffolk University poll last month, 44% of those surveyed said they plan to follow Trump's trial in New York, though the effect of a conviction could have on their votes seemed small. Among Trump voters, 84% said they would still vote for him if he was convicted in this trial or others. Among those who would change their vote, 8% would support a third-party candidate, and less than 1%, in other words, just 2 of the 336 Trump voters surveyed said they would switch to Biden. That said, in a very close contest, even a small switch in support, or the decision by some voters to stay home, can have a crucial impact. It's hard to miss the campaign trappings of the trial. Trump arrived in his signature garb. A blue suit, red tie, white shirt, with an American flag pin on his lapel. Before he left Trump Tower in the morning, he posted a series of attacks on his social media site Truth Social, attacking Judge Juan Merchan as crooked, the gag order as unconstitutional, and his prosecution as election interference. He blasted out one fundraising email, then another in his name, as he sat in the courtroom. Quote, "They're just a deep state plot from radical Democrats to come after you, and I'm the only thing standing in their way," he warned. In previous elections, by choice or necessity, some presidential contenders have campaigned in venues other than rallies with other tactics than speeches and debates. Eugene V. Debs, nominated by the Socialist Party of America, received close to 1 million votes in 1920 when he campaigned from prison where he was incarcerated on charges of sedition. He promised to pardon himself if elected. That year's election was won by Warren G. Harding, who campaigned mostly from his front porch, a technique used by other candidates of that era. Biden used a version of that in 2020, but from his basement in Delaware because of the COVID-19 pandemic. President Gerald Ford and other modern incumbents have run Rose Garden campaigns, staying close to the White House and emphasizing the trappings of incumbency. But a courtroom campaign? Well, we've never been here before.